My name is Evelyn Baher Murphy, and you're listening to Lifeblood, a podcast about Glen Canyon, Lake Powell, and the future of the Colorado River. Last episode, we talked about mega drought and the threat of Deadpool at Glen Canyon Dam, a basin facing a decision of how to adapt to new hydrologies and how to change when our infrastructure threatens to fail. For some, this is where the story really, really starts, with Glen Canyon coming back, with the myth of its loss and the promise of its return. Jack Schmidt is the director of the Center for Colorado River Studies and Watershed Sciences at Utah State University, and he was a friend of David Brower, the former Sierra Club president who let Glen Canyon Dam get built and then spent the rest of his life trying to get it removed.
I remember learning from Brower that when you fight these big fights that seem impossibly long, and you're probably not going to win, but are impossibly long fights, you got to find small little battles to win. And you got to make sure you celebrate those. It's the only way to sustain it. For fighting the long ones.
That lesson Brower taught is extremely relevant because for Brower and now generations of environmentalists, Glen Canyon Dam is a big, impossible fight. The dam has been written about ad nauseum in Southwestern literature. It's the main antagonist of Edward Abbey's book, The Monkey Wrench Gang, and it's a talking point at many riverside campfires. Some people won't even go near it, like my friend Abel Nelson.
I asked Abel what he'd expect to feel when he sees the dam for the first time.
I think I would be kind of sad. It represents sort of that thing that I have on just about every trip kind of railed against, you know, romantically from every river runner's perspective. It's one of those things that we would all like to not see there. That's more or less how I've come to think about Glen Canyon.
That's what was lost. Something that for some has mythological proportions. A canyon that now drowned is reason for heartbreak. And I can't blame them. Rafters or river rats, as some like to call them, relate to rivers as a flowing, moving thing. They build a sense of place around it. And so you raft Cataract Canyon and you go on this wild ride, and then you end up in this flat pool called Lake Powell. And then you go downstream and you raft the Grand Canyon. You're there for some 21 odd days and 280 miles of infamous rapids like Crystal and Lava Falls. And for all that time, you're being consumed by the sheer scale of the canyon. And then your journey ends in a flat pool called Lake Mead. So then, when you hear these stories of this Eden that was Glen Canyon, and maybe you see some pictures of it back in the day, you can convince yourself that you know what it was like and how wonderful it must have been. Because Grand Canyon and Cataract and the San Juan and all these sections in the Colorado River Basin are so incredible. You know Glen Canyon was too. John Weisheit was never in Glen Canyon before the dam, but he was there when the lake was filling for the first time. He watched parts of Glen Canyon disappear.
I learned my hatred for Glen Canyon Dam on a houseboat trip in Lake Powell. You could still see Indian ruins. You could still see cottonwood glens. You still had to hike miles to get to Rainbow Bridge. And then in 1973, the reservoir rose 90 feet. And all the Indian ruins, all the cottonwood glens were buried. And that's when I went, oh, I get it.
Today, as the executive director of Living Rivers, John may hold the title for the individual who has sued the Bureau of Reclamation the most times. And he's not alone in feeling that things could be different. In 1996, some people were like, let's not give up on this. What would it look like to restore Glen Canyon? And what argument can be made to make it happen? Eric Balkin is the current executive director of what became the Glen Canyon Institute.
People basically said, this is crazy. this will never happen. You know, you guys are nuts. But the idea at the time when Rich Ingebretson, our founder, started this organization was let's pull together everybody who knows about this canyon and this river system. Let's pull together scientists to see if we can make an argument. And so he brought in, you know, David Brower, the former director of the Sierra Club, Katie Lee, Martin Litton. He brought in scientists like Jack Schmidt. He invited people from Reclamation to like have this conversation. And it was absolutely seen as crazy at the time.
And maybe at the time, they were kind of crazy. The status quo in 1996 was a full Lake Powell, and the status quo was quoing. And frankly, a lot of the environmentalists had shifted gears. Author Zach Podmore studied this phenomenon in his recent book, Life After Deadpool.
The battle over Glen Canyon Dam was really important for the environmental movement in the 60s, but by like the 80s and 90s, that the new generation of people who were working for environmental groups, you know, saw that battle as lost and adjusted to the new reality that Lake Powell was there and it was probably going to be there for hundreds of years as far as they knew.
In the early 2000s, the mega drought threw a huge wrench in all of that. Lake levels dropped nearly 100 feet. And that meant that 100,000 plus acres of Glen Canyon was now exposed. That land was no longer underwater. We'll be right back after a few messages from our sponsors.
Hi, this is Seba River Outfitting from Flagstaff, Arizona. We're a full-service outfitter for non-commercial Grand Canyon river trips. From equipment and food to transportation and logistics, we take care of all the details so you can focus on the river. We're proud to support Evelyn's podcast on water issues in the Southwest, and we're honored to outfit many of the science missions in Grand Canyon. Planning your own trip? Visit SabaAdventures.com to get started.
This episode of Lifeblood is brought to you by Firefly Kitchens. Flowing through seven states and nourishing millions along the way, the Colorado River is a reminder of how powerful and essential the right kind of flow can be. At Firefly Kitchens, they believe your body deserves that same kind of vitality. That's why they handcraft wild fermented foods, krauts, kimchis, and tonics, alive with probiotics to keep your gut, immune system, and energy in balance. Each jar is made with care, flavor, and a whole lot of life. Because when your gut's thriving, everything else flows better too. You can explore their full lineup and order online at fireflykitchens.com. Firefly Kitchens, keep the good things flowing. This episode is also brought to you by Colorado River and Trail Expeditions. Looking to float down the Colorado River? Well, lucky for you, you can raft the Grand Canyon, Cataract Canyon, and more with Colorado River and Trail Expeditions. For over 50 years, Crate has been crafting world-class whitewater rafting trips through the West's most stunning landscapes. With Crate, you can raft through the heart of the Grand Canyon, hike to hidden waterfalls, and camp under the stars, all with expert guides who handle the details, so you can focus on making memories. Book your 2026 expedition now at crateinc.com. That's CRATEINC.com. Now, back to the show.
Oh my gosh, it just goes.
Wow.
And there's a beach over there if we need to dock.
That's me and Page residents Jaden Gomez, Shannon Herbst, and Beth Henshaw. We're in a place called Ice Cream Canyon on Waweet Bay in Lake Powell. The watercolor just changed from a deep blue to a bright turquoise. And the canyon walls on either side of us are a bright Colgate white. It almost hurts to look at them. We dock and hop out onto a small sandy beach. As we walk a little ways up the canyon, scattered about are old cans and bottles, boating camps long forgotten since lake level dropped. And around a corner, we see that the canyon walls give way to sediment banks towering on either side of us. Small willow trees are growing, their tendrilled red roots coming out of the sand like many fingers clinging to the sediment. Life is bouncing back.
Will all these plants anchor that sediment, or eventually like some flash flood will like just destroy all the...
Oh, it'll totally. Yeah. Once the lake's down, it's just gonna wash out. Mm.
Educator Shannon Herbst is spot on. These landscapes of sediment left behind from the retreating lake last long enough for plant life to spring out of them, yes. But in time, all that sediment will be blasted away by flash flooding, and the rocks will be laid bare again. for Shannon, the transient life of sediment puts things in perspective.
Yeah, I feel like the first time I really walked out in these canyons up above the lake, I started to realize how laughable the dam is, because you watch as these mountains are crumbling around you and you see the amount of debris and sediment that's coming down on a daily basis with wind, with rain, and you just have to laugh because the dam is nothing in comparison to those forces. And it is wild to be out here and see that geologic scale. I don't think you can really understand it until you are in the presence of it.
Those forces can also be seen up lake, where the Returning Rapids Project is studying what is happening to the sediment in Cataract Canyon. Cataract is the transition zone where river becomes lake, and there the sediment is piling up more heavily. Mike Dehoff is the principal investigator for the project.
Historically in Cataract Canyon, there is somewhere between 50 and 70 rapids, depending on who was counting and what the water level was and what they considered a rapid or not. When the reservoir was the whole way full, only 22, 23 of those rapids existed.
Now, in the same way that Ice Cream Canyon is coming back, the rapids in Cataract are coming back too. But to do that, the river has to carve away all the sediment that has accumulated. And up there, they're seeing some pretty big movements.
It was one thing to think about Glen Canyon getting flooded with water. It's a whole other thing to watch it getting encased with canyon wall to canyon wall mud. You're seeing things like a sediment slump in this small little canyon called Narrow Canyon that 1.3 million cubic meters of sediment moved in 4 hours. It was akin to two Costco-sized buildings sliding the length of a semi-truck.
These changes in Cataract Canyon and Glen Canyon are not really being managed by anyone. There's no master plan to let these places come back, and there's no plan to say where all that mud should go or how to restore habitats. What's remarkable, though, is the canyons are coming back on their own. They're restoring themselves.
Jack Stouse was the program coordinator at Glen Canyon Institute.
Some of this landscape has been out of water since the initial drawdown in the early 2000s. And some of those places are, you would never know they were once underwater. They're completely unrecognizable as a reservoir inundation area. I mean, we've seen places come back that even I thought we would never see in a certain way. Like, okay, this feature is out, but it's still like halfway under sand. And then a year later, after water is really evacuated, we're hiking into that same canyon. And then a monsoon cycle blasted all the sand out. It's like now we have a 60-foot waterfall back.
All sorts of places are being revealed. For River Guide Ben Reeder, they represent family memories. You see, in 1965, Grandpa Reeder spent some time in Glen Canyon.
So I have a picture on my wall in the living room of them in the Cathedral of the Desert. It's really, really, really beautiful.
In recent years, when the lake level has been at its lowest, the cathedral in the desert was no longer underwater, and Ben Reeder was able to revisit it.
I feel like the pictures that I was taking were not as good. It felt like black and white because of the bleach mark left from the full reservoir. But as I came back, and I came back again and again and took my kids there, it's amazing how fast it recovered, really.
Many people mentioned just how quickly Glen Canyon is recovering. A huge part of that is the resurgence of plant life in the habitats that they create. Those are all coming back. Here's Eric Balkin again.
You know, we've seen a ton of beaver activity, bighorn sheep, mule deer, bobcat. It's willows and cottonwoods and you know, cattails and maidenhair ferns on hanging gardens. And it's just like this breathing, vibrant place. It's not the same ecosystem that was there before the dam, and it is a disturbed ecosystem, but it's a healing ecosystem with really high ecological value.
And these habitats are crucial for bird species.
83% of the bird population in the state of Utah are dependent on riparian corridors, and less than 1% of the state is riparian. So in a place like Glen Canyon, where we have like over 100 miles of riparian corridor coming back to life effectively, It's really important from an ecological perspective.
The rapid rate of recovery just shows how fast Glen Canyon can return. Mike Dehoff likes to remind people.
If it took 18 years to fill Lake Powell, and Lake Powell were to go away, and we were to give the river corridors and side canyons 18 years to recover, I think we'd all be astounded at the rate of return and recovery. There's this one place where there are 40, 50 foot tall cottonwood trees that are all branched out like a giant lollipop tree that was underwater 12 years ago.
I don't know about y'all, but the idea of a place being flooded and kind of all that ecology dying, or at least the parts that were flooded, you know, that was all gone. And now that place is no longer inundated, the land is exposed again, and you have huge trees growing. It's like crazy to think about. This is just not the kind of story we hear every day. And it's not the story we tell ourselves about environmental restoration. You know, we have all these Superfund sites and places of just like gnarly pollution. And we kind of treat them as tainted and kind of lost. Just how we saw Glen Canyon in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. But today, Glen Canyon is showing us that it has the capacity to recover. As lake levels fell, hundreds if not thousands of archaeological sites that were underwater were no longer inundated. That means the sites that were frantically being documented in the salvage mission while the lake was filling were exposed again. And the thing is, back then, when archaeologists raced to collect data in Glen Canyon, they thought it would be for the last time. They thought all those sites would be destroyed by the lake. But today we're finding that things are in bad shape for sure, but not as bad as we thought. I asked Jeremy Childs, an interpreter at the Glen Canyon Recreation Area, about the newly exposed sites.
It was almost like packing them in bubble wrap. We thought, oh, surely they're destroyed, they're gone forever. But we found actually a lot of them, when you remove the sediment from around them, it protected them to an extent and encased them in sediment instead of washing them away. Because the rise of the water was so slow and gradual, the sediment also slow and gradual, it's preserved a lot of it.
Yeah.
That bubble wrap proved to protect some very fragile cultural resources. Eric Stanfield is an anthropologist for the Navajo Nation Heritage and Historic Preservation Department, and he has joined archaeologists on the recovery projects.
We actually uncovered a pot, you know, probably 800 years ago. I don't recall exactly what type it was, but it still had a yucca cordage all the way around it, and it had been under the lake for 40 or 50 years. It was pretty amazing. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it shows that, you know, there's some things that can, you know, stay intact. And in some ways, like that cordage, for example, being that deep under cold water, you know, an environment where there's no oxygen, I mean, it preserved it quite mm-hmm. well.
In some ways, Jeremy and Eric's experiences are exceptions. It goes without saying that all of the sites below lake level have been damaged.
They're important, they're fragile, and they're irreplaceable. You know, once they're gone, they're gone.
That's Kim Spurr. She's the Archaeology Division Director at the Museum of Northern Arizona. And what they've noticed is that sites that were in narrow, twisty canyons were more protected. Boaters have to move slowly through them, so there's less wake, and the lake level changes more gradually. It's different, though, for sites in wide, heavily trafficked bays.
In the big, wide-open bays, where boats go really fast, sites in those areas are in much worse shape because the boat wakes, they disturb it. After the walls get collapsed, then it just pushes them around. And we went back to a few alcove sites that basically everything had been washed out of, and the sites were really gone.
Kim showed me a before and after photo of that alcove. The before is from the 1950s salvage mission, and the after was taken just a few years ago. In the before, you can see a stone structure. And in the after, a pile of rocks. Kim also showed me before and afters of a pictograph, an ancient painting on the canyon wall. In the before photo, there's a large figure, about 4 feet tall. And in the after, it's completely gone. That's because pictographs are being encased by the bathtub ring. The calcium carbonate buildup on the canyon walls creates a white rind.
Pictographs, which are painted, and that rind peels off, it takes the paint with them. So pictographs that have been inundated, sometimes you can still see them under the rind, but as that rind begins to dry and peel, a lot of those will probably be destroyed.
Despite the resurgence of native habitats and rediscovery of archaeological sites, lake levels are still being managed to generate power and to meet delivery requirements under the compact and law of the river. So all this land and all these ecosystems that have come back in and around Lake Powell, they're not protected. Although it's unlikely Lake Powell will ever be full again, even a few wet years in a row could send thousands of acres of land underwater. Those cottonwoods, waterfalls, and archaeological sites would be flooded again. So the story of Glen Canyon's remarkable resurrection is one of tempered hope. And Glen Canyon Institute, while they're celebrating the recovery we've seen so far, they're also fighting a long battle. But they have a plan. It's called Fill Mead First. But more on that next time, in the final episode of Lifeblood. If you want to see pictures of willow trees growing in the sediment, or archaeological sites pre and post inundation, or of rapids returning, check out the show notes. And if you want to learn more about water management in the West, Jeremy Childs has a recommendation for you. This one is a classic.
For me, the Bible about water in the West has been Cadillac Desert by Mark Riesner. It was prophetic in a lot of the ways that we're still struggling to manage this issue. So yeah, I would say Cadillac Desert would be something I think anyone interested in the Colorado River or water in the American West in general, you need to read that book.
Episode 5 of Lifeblood was produced and directed by me, Evelyn Baher Murphy, and made possible by support from the Hulbert Center for Southwest Studies, the Colorado College Journalism Institute, the Utah Rivers Council, Colorado River and Trail Expeditions, Firefly Kitchens, Saber River Outfitters, and Outdoor Odyssey Sea Kayaking. Music in this episode is by Abel Nelson, Sabrina Smith, Sam Johnson, Charlie Stacy, Alex Rhodes, The Rustabouts, and Elliot O'Brien.